You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, the world's first legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English.
Hello and welcome to the Study Legal English podcast. I am your host, Louise, and today I'm very pleased to be joined by Roger Margand, who is a partner at the law firm called Spire Solicitors. First of all, Roger, tell me a little bit about how you came to become a solicitor. What was your training process?
When I qualified, didn't have the same choice as you have now in terms of modular degrees. Mm-hmm. So you had to go and do a pure law degree. You couldn't mix it in with other subjects. So I went through my GCSEs to give you an idea of just how old I actually am. I was the first year to do them.
I did GCSEs as well.
Yes, that was I was right on the dividing line. And then did A-levels, went on and did a straight law degree at University of East Anglia here in Norwich, and then went and did post-degree finals, I suppose you'd call them, LPC in new language for a year at Nottingham Trent.
Did you have any trouble finding a training contract? What did you do once you'd completed your studies?
Well, I qualified in 1996 and we're now in 2017 and nothing has changed. There's still a horrendous bottleneck. As a firm, probably interesting statistic, we get probably 10 applications a week for training contracts.
Gosh.
And we take four trainees a year. We've made a decision to go up to four, which is quite a lot. And it's really difficult. It is really tough. I also am part of the firm's work experience program. So for every week during the summer, for a day of that week, someone comes and sits with me who's doing work shadowing. The advice I'd have for anyone that was interested in going into the law is just get your foot in the door in terms of getting on the work experience program. Because if there's a connection and the people you're sitting with like you and you like them, that sometimes can get you to a point where they want to talk to you and meet you and interview you in a way that even the best CV can't.
When you are looking at CVs and you're having to deal with these 10 applications per week, how do you, if you haven't met the person, how do you sift between the good and the bad, or the successful and the unsuccessful? Is there some things that you particularly look for?
I think for us, we have a kind of profile in terms of the, if I can dare say it, a spire-shaped person that we're looking for. Most law firms, and we're no exception, look for minimum academic qualifications. We're looking for someone who is bright and who is committed. But we're kind of looking a little bit like the John Lewis model, for someone who's 100% ambition, but maybe 10% ego. Because sometimes the two can go hand in hand. And egotistical lawyers, I think, are the bane of the legal profession and probably the bane of their clients as well. But it tends to be around interest and colour. So I will expect people to apply to know what they want to do and to be quite clear about a career in the law. What I'm looking for is something a little different. The other thing we look for is community involvement, which is a big passion of mine.
If it's a big passion of yours, can you explain, elaborate a bit more?
I mean, we have a thriving education department. I've been a governor now for over 20 years, working in academies, comprehensive state sector. And education is something I'm passionate about. I'm also chairman of local CAB. And access to justice, I think, is one of the really big problems in this country at the moment. And again, it's something I'm passionate about. And I also work very closely with the local hospital and do volunteer work for the Prince's Trust.
Yes, very good. The CAB, for those of you who don't know what it is the Citizens Advice Bureau. I did some work experience with the CAB when I was a student. And the Prince's Trust is an organisation that helps launch startup businesses, which I also went on a Prince's Trust course, which was very helpful. Why did you choose to become a solicitor rather than a barrister?
I like the idea of presenting, and I love being on my feet, but the thought of doing it all day, every day, sort of, I had a kind of anxiety about that, because I thought, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to manage it. And I had a dad who worked in property, and he was a wheeler and dealer, and I love the idea of doing deals. And then when I actually sat behind counsel in court as part of my work shadowing, it became obvious to me that it wasn't much like the television. Bear in mind I was fairly young at that time, but there was no great emotive arguments. You're so wrapped up in protocol and procedure that to a certain extent, there's a limit to what you can do as a brief. Now, I'm sure if it was a barrister sitting here, he'd say, well, nonsense, say, you know, I could do this, that, and the other. But for negotiations, if you're doing deals and I'm a business solicitor by trade, then actually it's much, much more fun because there are much less parameters. And you can do something actually that benefits both clients. Whereas I tend to find in litigation, there's always a winner and unfortunately there's always a loser. Whereas a lot of business deals, both parties can come out of it feeling they've gained.
Do you ever do any litigation or is it mainly you're drafting documents and dealing with clients?
I run a department with people that do. Personally, most of my life is spent meeting people, advising them about their businesses, often helping them get off the ground for startups, which is just the best feeling in the world. People say to me, is it really great doing the really big deals, the tens, hundreds of millions of pounds? There's a kind of ego trip about it, but the best feeling I've ever had is helping somebody get through year one without failing to pay their tax, being made bankrupt, falling foul of a really difficult customer. That for me is actually what it's all about.
How did you come to work at Spire? And how did you become a partner and what work do you do there?
Okay, well, I mean, 60 seconds on that. Born in Norwich, went to university here really for financial reasons as much as anything. Didn't really fancy the gigantic loan thing. Obviously then had to borrow to go and do my finals, as I know everyone else does now, and much more than I did, I think, probably. Then came back here, qualified. I took my training contract first year for that as well, I think, in terms of the regulatory change here in Norwich. Then went out to a firm in Durham doing property and commercial work. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, I was talking to two other partners in two other firms I knew quite well, and we decided to merge. So the firm I'm in now has only been going 3 or 4 years. And I was one of the unlucky few who did all the paperwork, which, you know, top tip, never act with lawyers as your clients, particularly your partners in the firm. It's a difficult gig.
My clients are all lawyers.
Oh, goodness. Well, having them as clients, it's tough. It is tough, particularly when you're in business with them. I think that was the really harsh thing. But yes, the merger went through 3 or 4 years ago, and it's gone really well.
Yes.
Really well. A merger is often seen as being a magic bullet. You know, two businesses are in trouble. Let's merge and everything will be great. Actually, there's a big failure rate, and it can be really tough.
Yes. So, what was the process of merging? What kind of things did you have to do?
Okay. So for a merger to work, each party has to have something that they're prepared to lose and something that they know they're going to gain. And that something has to be tangible. And there's all sorts of negotiations around people, salaries, rationalization, what you're going to do with the assets, how you're going to bring it together, property. But really to sell it to your three groups of partners, all of whom are very nervous about joining together, you have to have a flag you can wave. But you have to be prepared to give something up too. And what worked very well with our firm was because it was a three-way merger, the conversations were adult, and they were very sensible, but you have a natural majority. So you're always going to get to a point where you don't agree, but it's very easy when three of you are doing it because you're always going to have that natural majority.
Yes.
Unless, of course, all three of you don't want to do it, in which case you shouldn't do it anyway.
Yes.
So it worked really, really well. We've settled well. And then, of course, the big thing you have to talk about as early as you can is culture.
Yep.
So you have to try and think about how the new firm will look, because each one of the three firms that came together, and I managed one of them, have different cultures, have totally different cultures, different approaches, different ways of working. And it's trying to pull them together. And I do all the sanctions and regulatory work, and I took on the compliance role when the firms merged. So a big part of the first year was me driving around all the offices, meeting everyone in the entire organization, and basically talking to them about what they thought Spire would look like in a way that was different to each one of the constituent three firms that have merged, which was fun, a lot of mileage, a lot of hours in the car, but by the end of it, I'd met every single person in the firm, and that was a really, really good thing.
How would you define the culture of Spire now?
There's that kind of Spire-shaped person.
Yes.
That we try and work around. So we have a case. If I give you a real world example, mm-hmm. I was interviewing somebody who wants to join us, and they had a young family, and they said to me, you know, what are your expectations? What are your expectations? And I said, well, it was a gentleman looking to join one of our departments, and I said to him, well, first expectation is I'd like you to be a really good father. Mm-hmm. My second expectation is I'd like you to go to all your daughter's sports days. And I want her to remember her first day at school because you were there to say goodbye and to tell her to have a good day. Mm-hmm. I said, because actually your job and your personal life have to mesh, because I know that if you're happy and you're fulfilled at home, you will be an outstanding lawyer here. And mm-hmm. I know conversely, if I'm telling you you need to be in and you need to miss your daughter's first sports day or the run into school, you'll be terrible. It won't work, because you will resent being here, and actually your work will suffer. And fundamentally, I'd rather you were happy and slightly less profitable and slightly less successful than you were a miserable, successful person, because eventually it will all blow up. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing that you try and promote. Now, having said that, before it sounds like I'm sort of doing this wonderful wonderland where everything is great.
The ideal law firm.
There are long hours.
Yes.
There are unreasonable deadlines. There are clients who are very stressed and want things done yesterday. And those all have to be done. Mm. But it's all about taking the flexible approach and never forgetting that bottom line, that actually there's a kind of happiness quotient that we need to be satisfying here. And that is just as important as the chargeable hour, as the billable target, as the long hours culture. For me, I want to work less and achieve more. That's always been my mantra.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very admirable.
Achieving it is a nightmare. Probably take me the rest of my working life to get there, but it's an admirable goal.
What are the differences between lawyers who work in-house, if you have any experience of that, or if you know anyone who works in-house, compared to working in a firm?
I think fundamentally, if you only have one client, then there are different challenges and opportunities to having a lot. Mm. So I have, I suppose, probably 70 to 80 matters on at any one time. And there are all sorts of different clients behind those matters. And they're all fantastic people. I'm lucky in that I pretty much love all my clients for different reasons. But they're all very different in terms of their needs and aspirations. Mm-hmm. If you're working for one big corporation, you'd think that would be easier. But in many ways, that presents a really difficult, different set of challenges, because you've got an entire entity to think about. There's all the dynamics of the work you're doing, fitting in with other departments, other committees, other jobs. From the people I know who work in-house, it's a different kind of pressure. There is a kind of commerciality around private practice where you are watching your time. You are very, very close on the time management. And I often speak to my in-house colleagues and say, well, it's not the same for you because you've only got the one client. And they say, yeah, but it's a different kind of time pressure. There's a lot more justification of your own existence inside a big corporation, I understand.
Yes. What are the different differences between working as an associate compared to being a partner, the different types of solicitor within a firm?
Right, okay. First of all, we're all solicitors. Uh-huh. So the kind of associate, mm-hmm. senior solicitor, partner, member, they're all kind of internal ranks. And I'm not terribly sure there's actually an equivalence. Mm. So I'm not terribly sure that, you know, a senior solicitor in a really big firm is the same kind of seniority as an associate in a slightly smaller firm. It really is a kind of mix and match. You tend to find that people get promoted because of what they've been able to demonstrate they can do, where they are in the firm, the kind of work they're doing, the kind of importance. Their management skills are a huge part in it as well. We have a solicitor, associate, a partner, and then above partner, we have people that actually own the firm itself. Mm-hmm. So they would be the kind of traditional idea of partners. But actually those terms are mixed up as well, because the legal terminology around a partner, as you and I both know, is somebody who owns mm-hmm. part of the business. Mm-hmm. Yet for limited liability partnerships, which is what Spire Solicitor is, the people that own the partnership, as it were, or own the entity mm-hmm. are called members. So all hopelessly confusing. But the terms are used interchangeably. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's more a case, I think, for anyone joining a firm of just sussing out how that structure works and talking to the firm about what the criteria are, because any well-run firm will have a set of criteria that they would measure you against via yearly, half yearly, or as the fashion is now, monthly appraisal, for you to go up to the next level.
Do you also differentiate between equity and non-equity partners? Do you have,
yes.
Or would that be within that distinction?
Yes, I mean, there is the old notion of the salaried partner. The salaried partner is quite an old term, but one that's still used in quite a lot of firms, where somebody is partner level and they have the sort of the authority to buy in the firm, but they don't have a they haven't bought a bit of the business. And that's always a difficult one to try and get your head around, because on the one hand, you're holding yourself out as being somebody who can make big decisions and somebody who theoretically could be pursued if there was ever a claim, but on the other hand, you don't own any of it. I've never really been hugely comfortable with the concept of it, because for me, a partner is a partner is a partner. You know, it kind of has a context. But no, that term is still out there, and there's still people in firms who have very senior titles but don't actually own or don't have an equity holding in the organisation they're part of. Yeah, that's still very much the case.
What would you say the are the essential skills for lawyers?
I don't believe it's necessarily knowledge. It's a very pat answer to go, we have to know a lot. You need to know where to go to find the knowledge you need, but actually you don't need massive retention. There's this kind of image of lawyers are being able to spout law and regulation. Clients are looking for solutions to their problems. If they want something to spout law and regulation, you just Google.
Yeah.
Just Google it and it'll give you all the regulation and law that you want. They're looking for someone that can take their problem and solve it. So empathy is massive. Empathy is massive. You have to be able to sit with a client and suss out what they want. And often what they want is not what they tell you they want. That's the first mistake. The first mistake is you listen to what they want. You go away and do it. They then go, oh, that's not what I really wanted. And you're like, well, that's what you told me. You need to look behind the curtain and you need to be able to suss out and feel where the client wants, particularly with business transactions, because what they say to you is their bottom line at the beginning of a transaction turns out to be nothing of the sort at the end. So empathy is useful. Adaptability is useful. The one thing I love about my job is it's a constantly changing scene. I never get the same problem twice. I never get the same situation twice. I never draft the same document, really, twice. No, there's always a change. I mean, there are some parts of law that are very transactional. Property work would be one of them, residential property work, where you do draft the same thing again and again and again and again and again. But I'm lucky in that with business, it's still, there's a lot of an entrepreneurial kind of attitude out there. And you do get people that just want to try something different. So that would be the second. The third would be, calm, actually, because you're managing your time, you're managing your clients, you're managing within your team. If you get to the point you're running a team, you're managing your team. All of them want their place in the sun. They all want their time with you, and they don't want a queue. So managing all of that, you just got to keep calm.
When I was a student, the buzzword was commercial awareness. That students have to be commercially aware. And how would you define that? Do you think that's an important skill?
It's important to be on top of your subject, yes. But I think that for me, it's more important to be plugged into what's going on in the environment around you. I believe that to be a good lawyer, whatever community you work in or hinterland you serve or organization you're part of, you need to be plugged into that and you need to be aware of what's going on it and you need to be on top of it. Because I think that way it makes you really effective. So as a business lawyer, I'm plugged into what my local community does, but I also read around a lot in terms of current affairs and periodicals to see what the broader commercial environment is. Because lawyers these days do a lot more than just transactional work. We're advisors. We advise our clients. We often sit with them as they go through commercial transactions or even commercial changes. And we're there not just to tell them about the law, but also to tell them about maybe how it should work from a business perspective. And whilst I would never say that we're business consultants that do a bit of law, I do think that we are lawyers that do a bit of business consultancy. And to do that, you need to understand the market that you work in. And you can't just be focused on what the law says. You have to be focused on actually what works in practice, what happens in practice, how does this translate into your world, into the industry that you, my client, are working in. And, you know, any lawyer, you know, he or she will have a real sense of that. And if they do, they're a long way down the road to being really effective.
Thank you. That brings us to the the end of this episode. So thank you for coming on the show.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. And to find out more, you can go to www.studylegalenglish.com. Don't forget that podcast pro members can get access to further learning materials. And if you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. So you can do so by email info@studylegalenglish.com. So thank you for listening and see you next time.